Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And good afternoon and welcome, welcome. Well, it's no secret that the beautiful landscape we have up here in the Pacific Northwest attracts a lot of creative people, writers, musicians, artists. And today we're joined by three Pacific Northwest authors. They didn't originate here, but they all chose to make their home here. We can understand why. They're going to take us from the frozen tundras of Saskatchewan to the fantasy world of dragons and mythical homelands, to the search for rapture, not in heaven, but right here on earth. As well as having the Pacific Northwest in common, each of my three guests writes their own version of their quest for meaning, belonging, and home. Later in the show, we'll talk with New York Times bestselling author and Asimov Reader's Award winner, fantasy novelist Robin Hood. She lives down in Tacoma. And we'll end today's show with New York Times notable Book of the Year recipient, award-winning nature writer, NPR commentator, and memoirist, Brenda Peterson. And she's made her home on Seattle's Salish Sea. But first, I'm pleased to welcome memoirist Beth Rolls Scott, who's joining us from Vancouver, British Columbia. You know, we talk with a lot of people on this show who are very inspirational. They've led inspirational lives. They've inspired others to do the same. And I have to say, Beth is no exception. She's accomplished more in her retirement years than many people do in their whole lifetime. So if you think you've seen your best days or you think this is it, then think again, because I'll tell you a little bit about Beth. She is described as a pioneer in the true sense of the word, but she describes herself, or used to be, a fat little girl from Saskatchewan who became the first female principal of a secondary school in British Columbia. And at the age of 60, she met the love of her life. So there is hope out there for those of you who think there's not. Together, the love of her life and Beth established an award-winning organization called Access. In 2006, she and her husband were recognized as outstanding Canadians by the Corporation of the City of White Rock. And Beth was named Woman of the Year by Sir Optimist International, an organization devoted to improving the lives of women and girls around the world. Her recently released memoir is called Pinch Me, A Long Walk from the Prairies. Beth Rolls Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely introduction.
Well, I have to ask you, first of all, Pinch Me. Why Pinch Me? I know the answer to this because I read it in the book, but tell our listeners why you called your book Pinch Me.
Well, you know, you started by saying that I saw myself as a sat on a trot of little girl, poor little girl from the prairies, and I was, and I have found a great deal of happiness. I'm a very happy person, and I'm now 81.
81 years young, right?
I'm 81. That's right. I've only just begun.
There you go.
But I sometimes say to my husband, George, is this real? Is this life real, or is it a dream? Pinch me so I'll know.
Well, that's
that's
a great testament to a good life with a good man, by the sound of it.
Oh, am I not lucky? I am lucky. And I like to tell people about that because, you know, they look at me and they say, well, if she can do it, I can do it.
Hmm. Well, much of your book is about the search for happiness or your quest at some point for, you know, am I happy? Is this real? As you just talked about. But I want to go back and we'll go through your journey and we'll talk about Access, the organization that you founded, because that's quite remarkable. But I want to start off, Beth, with sharing a little bit about you with our listeners, about your background, how you grew up, because you grew up on a farm in Saskatchewan. Tell us what that was like. You had two sisters. You lived 7 miles from a town called Moose Jaw. Your father drove to the grocery store once a month in his big, he had a big 1928 automobile. So tell us a little bit about what it was like to grow up as a small child in Saskatchewan.
Well, I was born in 1928, and you know that we talk about the dirty 30s in Canada and the United States. And so my growing up years, the first of them were in the dirty 30s. My father had a degree in agriculture, a Bachelor of Science. He had a homestead, but then he went out on his own, bought a new farm in about 1930, and never got a crop, never made a payment. So through those dirty 30s, he scrabbled away a living on this rented farm. We were never hungry. That's why I was fat.
You were not, by today's standards, you were not fat. I saw photographs of you.
Well, we're talking about memories here and what lasts. Yes. We had a good life. We were well looked after, but we didn't really have a jolly life.
Mm.
When I was 8 years old, my father got a salaried job, working for the provincial government. They were sending out tree seedlings to the farmers at this place where we lived called the Forest Nursery Station. And the seedlings were for the farmers to make windbreaks so that all of their soil wasn't blowing away. And so that's where I did where I lived during my teen years.
Now, you were just a kid, obviously, when the Great Depression hit, and you know, you said that your father didn't get a crop for 3 years, didn't receive any income on that. So what lessons did you take away from that and carry through your life, do you think?
You know, my parents were never resentful. Those years should have been their top earning years, their success years, and here they were stuck. I can remember years later my father saying to me, you know, when it lasts for 2 years, you think it'll be better next year. But when it lasts for 5 years, you wonder if it will ever get better. The years were, I think that what I learned was to grub away and do your best, and things will turn around. They worked hard. And I've been a hard worker. I think that's one of the big things that I learned.
Yeah, I think that's really evident in your book. You grew up with a theory about happiness. You said everybody told you that you could be happy if you had someone to love, something to do, something to look forward to. And up until that part of your life, you thought, well, that formula seems to work. It's a little simplistic, but it seems to work. But you talk, there's a chapter called Your Broken Dream. Your mother wanted, which was fiercely adamant, that all three of you girls would have a career so that you did not have to be dependent on a man. And so you became a teacher, but you really wanted to be a wife and a mother.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I missed it once or twice. Finally was married and had a long marriage and had a good life. Not necessarily a happy marriage, but a good life. In which I continued with my career because I didn't have any children.
Mm. And by this time, you had moved to British Columbia. You say in the book that you became the first principal or female principal of a secondary school in Vancouver. What was that like for you? What kind of challenges did that bring?
It was actually in Surrey, doesn't matter. It's near Vancouver. Well, I was a forerunner, and there was some pressure there to make it work. It was a man's job. You know, I soon thought, I remember right at first, I thought, what they need here is a big, strong man. And I even said that to the superintendent. And, you know, I should bite my tongue. It didn't take any strength, only strength of determination. And up until that time, why was it that women were not principals of secondary schools? there were only a very few who were principals of elementary schools.
Mm.
But it was a man's job, as were many jobs at that time.
Right. So
I think the big challenge was to not screw up.
Yes. Well, obviously you didn't, because you forged the way for many more women there, too.
Oh, there are lots of women now that are principals of secondary schools and doing a wonderful job.
Yeah.
Showing real leadership.
I think it's easy to take that kind of thing for granted today, but we forget that, you know, there were people like you who pioneered the way there. So let's eventually you did get divorced from your husband. You did have a
yes.
long-term marriage, but you divorced. You were single for how long?
For 11 years.
11 years. And then
11 years.
60 mm-hmm. years old, and you met the love of your life. Tell us about this wonderful man you met.
Well, George was also retired. I was retired by that time. And George also was retired. He'd had a career as a lawyer. He and I had mutual friends. I had met him long, long before. When George and I were married, his former wife had died 3 years before. We used to run into each other on the boardwalk along the beach. I found myself going for that walk at, you know, sort of opportune times. They say, and they met not merely by chance. Ho,
right.
Ho.
No such thing as coincidence, huh? So you retire from work because you worked all of your life, but didn't take very long for you to get bored, did it?
No.
So
well,
how did you just go ahead?
There's my formula, you see, someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to.
Right.
Well, I've always needed that piece, something to do.
And so you decided to do what?
Well, after George and I were married, you know, the idea was we were going to spend our winters in Hawaii and our summers here, and that didn't suit me very much. George and I went actively looking for a charity that we could support. We had read a wonderful book called Save Three Lives. It's written by Robert Rodale. It was written by Robert Rodale, who was an organic farmer, an organic gardener. He's now dead. He said in his book that if all of us would be careful about where our charitable dollars went, that we could all save three lives. Each of us could save three lives. So George and I thought about that a lot, and we decided that, well, why wouldn't we save three lives? And so we went looking for a charity that we could join. But in fact, we set up an NGO, a non-governmental organization, which we started ourselves.
And that's called Access.
It's called Access, which is for African Canadian Continuing Education Society. Our work is providing education. We feel that the best way that we can bring people out of poverty is through education.
Mm.
And our work is in Kenya.
And why did you choose Kenya?
Well, because we followed another organization called CHESS, which is also a Canadian organization that was giving scholarships to secondary students. And the leader of that group, whose name is Laurie Williams, Laurie told us that the best way we could help her was to start another organization that would give scholarships for her graduates, for the students who had finished secondary school. And that's how we began.
Mm. Well, you're being kind of modest here, so let's talk a little bit more about this. Let's go into a little bit more detail here, because you've actually built 10 primary schools in Kenya and helped thousands of young people attend university through scholarships.
Yes.
Access is the acronym is ACCES. Tell us how difficult was it to get it off the ground and keep it running? Because often when people try things like that, it's that first year or two that's really tough and challenging to keep it going.
Yes. It's it wasn't that easy to get support, to get dollars, but we went to our friends and relatives first. We say that they started to duck into doorways when they saw us coming by because they thought we would be asking for more money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But so a little bit at a time, I remember a most wonderful breakthrough time happened when we were sent a check from someone that we didn't know. And then we knew it wasn't just friends and relatives, but the circle had widened.
Mm-hmm.
We did at first, well, we still do, connect a person. If you give us money for a scholarship, then we tell you who to whom that scholarship is going.
Right.
And you get a letter from that student and help them to go to school.
Mm. And this has been going since 1993. May I ask how old George is, your husband?
He's 3 years older than I am. He's 84 now.
He's 84. 84 and 81 years old, and you're still doing this wonderful work. That's truly amazing. It really is amazing.
Well, in time, at first we did it ourselves. We collected the money. We saw that it got to Kenya, that it was banked, that it was looked after. In time, it became impossible for us to do it here.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of, you know, we started as a kitchen table organization. And we had to move to an office and have an executive director, which we've had for 5 years now. But at first, it was a lot of work. I think one of the good things that we've done is that we've backed off. We've said if this organization is going to be sustainable, it won't be sustained by 80-year-olds. And so whereas I was president and George vice president, we are no longer. We have new presidents. We're a third president is now in charge, and we have the ED to do the work, the administration of the organization.
Right. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Beth, but I want to just say you write about happiness. I never did find a way to trap it, but I did have enough sightings of this elusive, mysterious happiness and enough help from those who loved me to give me a formula from which to make my own happiness. And I think the book's very enlightening. I enjoyed reading it. You have a wry sense of humor. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Oh, I would like them to know that I'm going to be doing a signing of the book at Third Place Books in Seattle on Friday.
That's this coming Friday, March 5th. I believe it's at 6:30, Third Place Books, the one,
yes.
And it's the one in Bothell, the Bothell kind of area, Lake Forest area.
Yes, it
yes.
is.
Yes,
yeah. It is.
Yeah.
And so I would like to tell people that, and I would like them to look at our website, which is www.accesskenya. Have to watch, Access has only one S.
Okay, so accesskenya.org. Beth Rell Scott, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your journey.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
You're welcome. And we'll be right back. We'll be talking with novelist Robin Hobb, author of The Dragon Keeper. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
To live, white lace and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org. NorthwestLegal.org.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, learn the shocking truth behind many malpractice situations. But first, discover how everyday household items could be responsible for your trip to the hospital in the first place. That's coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for more information and find hundreds of archived interviews on business advice, medical breakthroughs, personal growth, adventure, and more.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And yes, we've just begun.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking today with three Pacific Northwest authors. My next guest has been writing published works for the past 30 years and is described as one of the most gifted fantasy writers today. Robin Hobb is a New York Times bestselling novelist who also writes under the name of Megan Lindholm. Her short fiction won the Asimov Readers Award, and she's authored several trilogies. Her latest book is one of the Rainwild Chronicles, The Dragon Keeper. It's the first book in a new trilogy. Robin Hobb, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
And you're joining us from Tacoma, local.
Oh, that's right, very local, yes. I'm up here not too far from the zoo and things.
Oh, yeah, well, I walk down there all the time with my dog down at Point Defiance.
That's beautiful, especially this time of year.
Yeah, it is. So give us a little bit of background on your book, if you would. It's called The Dragon Keeper. It's the first in a new chronicles, in a new trilogy. Tell us a little bit about the trilogy, set that up for us, and then tell us a little bit about Dragon Keeper, if you would.
Well, it wasn't intended to be more than a single book. I wrote the manuscript and sent it in, and my editors looked at it and said, we're going to actually divide this into two books. So at this point, the book that's out in the bookstores right now is called The Dragon Keeper. It will be followed fairly quickly in May by the second half, which is called Dragon Haven. In this story, I am returning to a setting that some of my previous readers will recognize, which is the Rainwilds, rather like our own Pacific Northwest rainforest.
Uh-huh.
Only, and with volcanoes and earthquakes, it will be quite a familiar setting to Northwestern readers, I think. And with the additional addition that dragons, which have been extinct through a strange series of quirks, have actually come back into the world, but they are not fully formed and capable of taking care of themselves. So the humans who have struck a bargain with the one very viable and very assertive adult dragon are faced with the task of caring for these animals and also with moving them far enough away from the human city on the Rainwild that the dragons don't do any more damage to the city and the inhabitants.
Mm. How do you keep all of this in your head? Because you've built this great big mythological landscape almost, very mystical. How do you keep it all in your head?
I keep a lot of files on the computer. As my organizational task as a writer, as I go along, every time I use any proper noun, I immediately stop and enter it into my glossary file, and I make the addition of what page it occurs on, and I usually include a brief description of where it is or who it is or what it is at the time. And this enables me to quickly go back and say, now, were his eyes blue? And I can quickly find his name in my glossary and check it. Or to create a timeline and have it so that my characters from book to book or even from series to series do age at the same rate. You don't have somebody who gets 5 years older, while somebody else's age is 20 years.
Right.
Those
right.
are surprisingly easy errors to make when you're working on a long piece of fiction.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. You brought some characters from your previous trilogies into this book, and yet this is a standalone story, isn't it?
Yes, it is very much a standalone story. I do try to do that with every trilogy and indeed with every book within a trilogy. I think there's nothing more frustrating than being at the airport and the only book you can find on the rack that you want to buy is book 3 or book 5 of a series, and you dive into it and can't make sense of where you are. So I do my best to make each book standalone, to make sense, to have a beginning, a middle, and a somewhat satisfying ending, even if it's the first half of the story. There are some characters that were previously in the live ship traders that do cameo appearances, mostly because it wouldn't be very convincing if everybody who had existed in the Rainwilds was not at least mentioned in passing, mm-hmm. you know, political figures and who's in control and who owns the ships that are trafficking on the river. So they do come into it, but it's more like a quick glimpse that does move the story along and
right.
let previous readers know what these other characters are up to right now.
Right, it's like an insider thing there.
Oh, yes, it's like dropping in or Twitter.
There you go. Which authors have influenced you over the years?
Oh, I think if I started listing them, we would be here all day.
Well, give me a couple.
I'm standing right here by my bookshelf, so just reading across, I see a lot of Rudyard Kipling. I see Roger Zelazny. I see Peter S. Beagle, George R. R. Martin, Stephen Bruce, Emma Bull. Just quite a variety here. And if I drop down to the next shelf, I see, of course, my favorite mysteries, which would be like Robert Parker, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Michael Marshall Smith. And, well, there, you know, there's so many.
A lot,
Robert
you know.
Silverberg and Charles de Lint. Too many people to give all the credit they deserve for teaching me how to tell a really good story. I always think that if I look at what brings me back to an author and aim for that, to provide that to my readers, then I will hit the target.
Yes, yeah. Now, you've been writing for 30 years. How have you evolved as a writer? Because we do change with each piece, I think, that we write. But do you think you write differently now than you did in the beginning, or do you think you've just matured into that position?
Oh, I definitely believe that I write differently. I've actually been writing quite a bit longer than 30 years. I'm 57, and I was first published at 18.
Mm.
Now, when I began at 18, I was writing very short pieces, mostly for children's magazines. I was also working as a stringer for a local newspaper on Kodiak Island. But all of that early writing does come into learning the trade. For a number of years, I wrote as Megan Lindholm, and it was about, is it 30 years? Oh, my goodness, can't be that long. 20 years ago, I shifted over to using the pseudonym Robin Hobb. I think I write very, very differently as Robin Hobb than I do as Megan Lindholm. I continue to use the Megan Lindholm pseudonym for shorter works, and indeed, there are several novels I would like to write if I can ever find the time, as Megan Lindholm.
Mm-hmm.
I do see the two voices as being very, very different.
Mm. You grew up in California. You were born in California, but you grew up
yes.
in Alaska. And I read that it was there that you learned to love the forest and the wilds, which plays into your trilogy here. Why did you choose to make Tacoma your home, the Northwest?
Oh, I think a very very roundabout path brought us here, and like most people, a lot of happenstance. Let's see. I grew up in Alaska, and when I was married at 18, I moved to Kodiak to live with my husband there. We lived in Kodiak and Anchorage and Kodiak again, and we decided at one point that we, you know, should try something completely different, and we moved to Hawaii for a few years, and it was lovely climate, wonderful people, but it was a climate that didn't particularly suit me. That was a little bit too much of that bright sunlight. You know how you get that hole in the sky and the shiny thing shines through?
I remember that.
So we didn't have quite enough steam to move all the way back to Alaska. We ended up in Washington, and initially in Kent, and then we lived down in Roy for a while, and now we're in Tacoma. In many ways, Alaska is still home. I do love the educational opportunities that have existed for us here in Washington for as my children were growing up.
Mm.
And there are a lot more opportunities here to socialize with other writers, to see, to drive up to Seattle or to see a play here in Tacoma, to enjoy the amenities of civilization.
Yeah, lots of writers here. What? Tell us a little bit about the writing process for you and what's that like. Do you have a routine? Do you write when you feel like it? I'm guessing you don't, because you've written a lot. I'm guessing you have a routine.
Well, the routine varies a great deal. I do say that, you know, I'll fall back on the other, the greats of science fiction, Poole Anderson and Robert Heinlein, both of whom advise people to write every day and to finish what you start and submit what you finish. And that sounds so easy when I rattle it off, but making yourself sit down every day and saying, no matter what else is going on, I need to push this story forward at least two or three pages. If you can do that, in the course of a year, you're going to have a 600-page manuscript. And so even if you throw out 200 pages as being not up to quality, you're still going to end up with a very good book-length manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're in a good place now, but I'm sure in the beginning you faced a little rejection. How did you cope with that? How do you tell people to cope with rejection?
Oh, I have a huge fat file of all the rejection slips. And I look back at them. Every one of them was a learning experience. Because I was living in Kodiak at the time, there were not a lot of writing classes at that time or writer's workshops, and I was very much using trial and error to teach myself how to be a writer for many of the early years. And it takes a lot of market research and studying what is out there. I don't think you can be a writer who succeeds unless you are also a reader.
Mm-hmm.
Being willing to listen to editors who give you a chance is so extremely important. At the time when I first started writing, what we call in the SF and fantasy genre, there existed a lot of fanzines, which are tiny little magazines that people published out of their homes, sometimes with a Xerox or a mimeograph machine. But what they allowed you to do was to get feedback from an amateur editor and then from the readers who actually were very good about responding to the stories in the little fanzines. Those have been replaced largely now by the e-zines, the online magazines,
right.
Some of which are well-edited and well-run, and others where, you know, you feel like you're just reading the slush pile.
Right.
But they are so helpful to beginning writers, to kind of get in at the junior level and learn there until you feel like you're ready to step up to the larger magazines and publishers.
As a writer, what do you think is the best career advice you were given and the worst career advice you were given?
I think the best career advice for any writer is simply to start now and to persevere, to write what you know. And many young writers think that means that you have to actually go out and climb a mountain before you can write a story about being a mountaineer, or that you must have experienced being a trapper in the Old West before you can write about
right.
it. But what it really means is to write from who you are and where you are. Teenagers who want to write would do well, in my opinion, to write from the viewpoint of a teenager, because right now they know more about being a teenager in 2011 or 2010 than any of my research could ever yield to me. That is where their expertise lies, and if they write from where they stand right now, they're going to write strong stories that are very real to their peers. I think the worst advice that I could give to a young writer would be to say something negative about editors and publishers, to say, oh, they're trying to keep you down, or don't listen to what your editors say, they're just trying to make your work their own, or they're trying to steal your ideas. I've encountered a lot of young writers, new writers, who say that they chose self-publishing because that they had in their mind that there was some kind of an antagonistic relationship between editors and writers.
Right.
Whereas what my experience has been is that editors are very, very interested in putting out the best possible book. Their name is on that work, too. And they are interested in seeing it succeed and seeing it reach the greatest number of readers and in seeing it be an excellent, well-told story.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I think that's great advice. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Robin?
Well, if you are interested in becoming a writer, the thing to do is not to delay, to sit down today and begin today. You can't start any younger. And to write from the heart, right from the bone.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of getting too close or getting too to telling about, you know, what really exalted you or what really struck you down. Put yourself in your writing and write with your whole heart.
And where can listeners find out more about you?
Oh, I have a website at www.robinhobb.com. Certainly there, and on that website, down in the bottom right-hand corner, you'll find links that go to my live journal, MySpace, and also a news group on sff.net, where I go every day and chat with readers and other writers. And
okay.
Certainly, newcomers are always welcome there. We have a very good time.
Okay, fabulous. And that's robinhobb.com, and it's Hobb is spelled H-O-B-B-double-B.
That's correct.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And my guest again, Robin Hobb, her new book is called Dragon Keeper, and the second one is coming out fairly soon. So if you want interested, you want to get that soon so you can pick up the new one as soon as that one comes out. Thanks so much, and stay with us when we come back. We will continue our conversations.
Dragons may guard your door, but I'm on my way to save you. Devils wage unholy war, but I'm on my way to save you.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk Podcast Reviews, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk Podcast today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Spread the word. You don't have to settle for the usual talk radio. Now there's Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Dragons may guard your door, but I'm on my way to save you. Devils wage unholy war, but I'm on my way to save you.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And thank you, Eric, for that music as a tribute to our previous guest who wrote a book about called Dragon Keeper, Robin Hobb. The LA Times calls my next guest a hauntingly funny writer. I have to agree with them. Brenda Peterson is a novelist and nature writer who's authored 15 books, including Duck and Cover, which won the New York Times Notable Book of the Year award. Her memoir, Build Me an Ark, was chosen as best spiritual book in 2001, and her nonfiction books, including Living by Water and National Geographic's Sighting the Gray Whale's Mysterious Journey. Her works appeared in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Sierra, Orion, and Oprah. And for the past 17 years, Brenda Peterson has been an environmental contributor for NPR. Brenda Peterson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Vicky.
Well, I said I have to agree with the LA Times when they called you a hauntingly funny writer, because I did laugh out loud in this book. I wonder, it's been described as an unusual memoir in several reviews that I read. It's been described as a memoir where fundamentalism meets deep ecology. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Yes, that is from my beloved agent, Sarah Jane, who, when she first read the chapter that was published in Orion in 2008 called I Want to Be Left Behind, she said, you know, I've never seen anyone bridge these two worlds, the world of fundamentalism and the world of deep ecology. And you are the common ground, because in your own family, in your own work, you have found common ground. And often, bridge people are far and few. So she said, if you can make this book as funny and as tender as the life you've lived for this book, I think many people will really enjoy it. And that's what's happening.
Yeah. The book is called I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. So I learned a lot about Southern baptism. I did not know very much about it. I didn't know that the goal was to find rapture in heaven. But you tell us a little bit about your childhood, because I think that's quite significant, maybe in who you are today. Your father was a forest ranger. He actually became, I think, the head of some big division there.
He was not a ranger. He was a forester.
Forester.
And there's a difference. It's a slight difference. But he did end up becoming very high in the U.S. Forest Service. And so we grew up, particularly me as the oldest, on this very beautiful millions of acres of forest with only a few people. So my perspective from a very early age was that the environment and nature imprinted me really before too many people or too many belief systems could get to me.
Yeah.
And when we kind of grew up and had to put on shoes and go to Harvard to follow my father and his career, I was then struck by the fact that so many of our beliefs and our ideas were disembodied. For example, many religions' beliefs in the afterlife, in heaven, while they don't describe heaven so completely, they see it as better than this world or above this world or a destination after we endure the travails of this world. And that threw me into confusion, because I had been raised in this absolutely beautiful forest. And why would I want to leave it?
Mm. And you had a problem with that, too, because you could not, animals are not allowed into heaven under the religion that you were raised under. And you couldn't,
yes,
you couldn't balance that idea there.
And that was my first crisis of faith as a very young child, maybe about 9, when our Sunday school teacher, who breeded basset hounds, so she wasn't like she hated animals, had to tell us that there were no animals in heaven. And I thought, who would ever want to go there? I mean, it just sounds very boring. Mansions. For people who are always advertising heaven, there's very little real publicity about it or description of it. I find that very interesting, don't you?
I do. I do. And I agree with you. It sounds boring without animals. I couldn't imagine a place without animals. So your whole goal in putting this book together, it is a memoir. I believe you've written another memoir. So it's not a memoir from A to B. It actually could be read. You could just pick up and read a chapter, I think.
Yes, you could. Yes.
And each chapter is like a story in itself. I'm going to ask you to read a little bit to us, if you would.
Yes, I'll set the scene, Vicky. This is from the first chapter. And I'm sitting on the beach doing something called seal sitting with my neighbor, which means we basically watch over a seal pup when the mother is out fishing. So it's kind of like seal pup daycare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a neighborhood beach watch. We are a group of grassroots citizen naturalists, and I've been doing it for about 10 years.
And it's up here in Seattle, right?
It's here in Seattle, yes.
Yeah.
So all of you out there who are in this area, be on the look July through September for seal pups, these wild animals who are beautiful and trusting, and they haul out on our shores, and sometimes they're there for 8 to 10 hours while the mother is fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep our dogs off leash, and we put up a little caution tape around the pup, and we educate people as they walk by, and mostly people are quite thrilled to look through the binoculars and see this beautiful seal pup napping on the beach. So that's the first chapter, and I'm sitting with George, who's one of my favorite seal sitters, on our backyard beach. And he starts to proselytize me about the rapture, which is very familiar to me because of my childhood and because many of my relatives are believers in the rapture. So I try to get out of the conversation, but he's a friend, he's a seal sitter, and so I listen. And I'm trying to understand why he would be so happy to leave and why he's hurrying it up. And I say, basically, what's the hurry? And you're so cheerful about the end of the world, and don't you care about us left behind? And that's our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have this epiphany with him when the mother returns, and George says, "Ah, buddy, you're safe now," to the pup, and the pup goes back in the water with the mother. And George turns to me, and this is from that chapter. He says, "The mother has returned. That's my favorite part. It's like Christ coming back." And then I understood something about my neighbor and about myself. All of us know what it feels like to wait for someone to call, to finally come home, to recognize our love, to reunite with those of us who seek something greater than ourselves. Maybe it will come in the night, in the twinkling of an eye. Maybe it will save us from a lonely beach. There was tranquility in George's face, a sweet calm that comes from sitting on the beach all day with nothing to do but watch over a fellow creature. "You're a really good neighbor, George," I said. "We would all miss you so much if you zipped up to heaven. We'd all say, 'Well, there goes the neighborhood.'" "I'll miss you," he admitted now, "and all this, too." My neighbor looked at me thoughtfully as we watched a harlequin float past. Wave after wave lapped our beach, and the spring sun glowed on our faces. We sat silently, listening to waves more ancient than our young, hasty species, more forgiving than our religions, more enduring. Rapture.
Very good. Tell us, how do you define rapture? Because I really was ignorant of all of this until I started reading your book.
This is actually a very young philosophy. It's about 170 years old. Some people got together earlier in this country, and they kind of reinterpreted Revelations, not as the poet John of Patmos originally wrote it a long time ago after the death of Christ, but in the light of turbulent times, and they interpreted it as apocalyptic, and they read into it modern problems and struggles like the holy war in Iraq or Israel's becoming a nation, and they basically created this entire Left Behind series and structure on their interpretation. Now, that's fine and good, but when it starts becoming one of America's fastest-growing religions, when one out of three evangelicals believes in the rapture, and when it starts dominating foreign policy or environmental policy, as it did during the Bush administration, this short-sighted, very immature philosophy has caused great harm. And I wanted to look at this and make us conscious of the kind of stories that we're telling ourselves that could really, really impact our healthy planet and future generations.
You say that you found a lot of striking similarities between religious zeal and environmental fervor. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, Vicki, this was my kind of epiphany as a nature writer and an editor. I did a lot of editing and environmental work, and I began to feel very uncomfortable with the fact that what I call green, the apocalyptic greens, the people who say, oh, everything is going extinct and everything is melting and, you know, we're going to be dead in one generation. And that seemed to mirror the fundamentalist kind of end times that I was seeing in this rapture stuff and in some of the religions. And I made a list on page 189 in my book in which I looked at, but I just wrote in my notebook, environmentalist and fundamentalist. And to my shock, I didn't really want to look at this because I am an environmentalist. I saw that there was all these similarities, like enraptured by doom, apocalypse now, righteous anger, holier than thou, humorless, blame, shame, judgment, evangelical. And I thought, oh my goodness, I have to look out for fundamentalism in myself, among my green friends. It's fundamentalism is really not the way toward finding common ground and advancing the conversation.
Mm. Now, you you write for Nature. You write nature stories. You write. You commentate on NPR for about nature. What is the answer, do you think?
I think it's a complex and very deep conversation that we should be in with all faiths. You know, there's such a thing as environmental stewardship of God's creation. And there are many groups, like I write about this in the book, like Green Christians or Buddhists who are hearing the Dalai Lama's call for engaging with global climate change. There are many people who are moderate in faith who do see that a healthy planet and a habitat to give our next generations is part of their spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And I write about this in the second part of the book, and I actually talk about some of the generations in my family who are doing this kind of work, starting a recycling club in their school, you know. And that, it's not a glamorous answer. It's kind of every day doing something that you can do. But it's a mature look at our species and other species surviving, and not this kind of escapist end times or apocalyptic. Apocalypse is just too easy. We have to assume we're going to endure, and then we have to grow up about how to make this planet as beautiful and whole and healthy as possible.
Mm. Now, the book, again, is called I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. How, do you think you found rapture here on Earth?
I am looking here, for those of you who live by water, that was one of my books, Living by Water. I am sitting here on Alki Beach, looking out over the Olympics that are snow-clad. There are two ferries going by. This is a beach that has great blue herons, river otters, eagles, orcas, gray whales, and I sit here in paradise. And I'm talking to you and everyone in the world who may be living in their own rapture, and I don't have to go very far at all every day to experience the beauty of this world.
It's certainly a stunning landscape up here. We were talking about that at the beginning of the show today. What do you hope that readers take away from your book?
I think the best thing of this book, which I discovered, was to take ourselves a little less seriously and to take everyone else, other species, the natural world, a little more seriously. Meaning, if we see ourselves as characters who are doing the best we can, and we look at our lives as more of a comedy than a tragedy, everything lightens up. We don't act like the end of the world is upon us. We really act like we have a lot of time, and we can listen to others and use our sense of humor. As I just said recently, have you ever seen a fundamentalist stand-up comic?
No. Although I could laugh at some. I don't know whether to laugh or cry at some of them.
Exactly. But I think humor is a great bridge between all of these polarities. And that's why I use my own stories, my family, my own experience. And essentially, it's a dark, divine comedy.
Yeah. And what does your family think of your work?
Depending upon where they are, my brother, who's a military man and a conservative Christian, read every word of this book in manuscript and really helped me keep my balance, what I call the New Testament or harmony. There are people in my family in the South who are horrified by the book and consider that I'm laughing at their religion. But I always say I'm laughing at myself as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to elevate the conversation to a place of humor, which I think is the highest degree of intelligence.
I would agree with you, and I think that's the way we have to address issues. I really do. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I would like to thank your listeners for listening, and I would like to ask you to maybe go to my website, iwanttobeleftbehind.com, for a deeper glimpse into the book. It has video of my parents encountering their first gray whale in Baja. It has my NPR commentaries. It has a blog. And that way they can kind of have the book, and they can also have this glimpse into the book for more information. And I know you were talking about writing. I was listening in before.
Yeah.
Many people are writing memoir. And I think if you look at my book and look at the website, you'll see a kind of primer in how to write your own memoir.
Okay, thank you so much. We've got to run. We're right at the end of the show. Brenda Peterson, thank you so much for being with us. Great book, I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. Thanks for being with us on Conversations Live. See you next week. Live well, live strong.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, learn the shocking truth behind many malpractice situations. But first, discover how everyday household items could be responsible for your trip to the hospital in the first place. That's coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for more information and find hundreds of archived interviews on business advice, medical breakthroughs, personal growth, adventure, and more.
Views expressed on the preceding program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those